When the last tap pounded the golden spike into place, the telegraph operator standing alongside tapped out the word, done. Whistles blew and hats flew through the air. The transcontinental was done, but railroading in Utah had really just begun. Within a few years, a railroad spur to Salt Lake was completed. Ogden had started to become a bustling junction city, and the Utah Northern was coming over the Mendon Hill and dropping into Cache Valley. At UPR, we've been collecting train stories. Today we celebrate by saying hats off to the men who worked on the trains and three cheers for the people who live by the tracks. Norm Frost was 19 when he hired on the Union Pacific as a brakeman.
Born in Ogden, still live in Ogden, born here near the railroad tracks, never left them, been in my blood all my life actually. Started railroading as a young man and took a certain kind of man to be a railroader because it was time consuming. We never knew when we were going to work or when we were coming home. Tough on wives. About 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon, the phone would ring, way I'd go. So you had to love it, and had to be a certain kind of a man to enjoy railroad. 42 years I spent with the Union Pacific as a brakeman. Team, like I say, a team effort. Dispatcher, conductor, brakeman, engineer, and fireman. All working together. I'd run for switches. I never stopped a train unless I had to. Stop a heavy train with a steam engine, why, you might be 15, 20 minutes getting it started again. If you just slowed down 4 or 5 miles an hour and kept the train moving, brakemen could run up ahead of you and get that switch. They could go right into a path. Never stop you. And those engines got hot. We had we had 7 tunnels at one time between here and Wasatch. Some of them small, didn't bother us much. One just below Wasatch, just short of a mile long. About 300 feet on the east end of this tunnel had sloughed away, and they built it up from the inside. Fine when they had small locomotives. But when we got this big boy, which was the largest steam engine in the world, we could reach out the window and touch the wall in this tunnel without extending our arms on either side. And it got hot, what I mean, in that tunnel. They've had thermometers go through there on a normal run, get up to 190 degrees. Before we get up to these long tunnels, I'd go back and get in the water tank. Against the rules, of course, but We kind of stretched a few rules here and there. Down the center filling spot where they put the water in this tender was a ladder. You get right down the inside, nice, cool. He's nice in there, but there's not once, but several times, I came out of the water tank into the cab and found the engineer and the fireman both passed out on the deck from the heat. There's a conductor and 2 brakemen on each crew. 1 brakeman on the engine, 1 on the caboose. Their job was flagging, the rear man, and all the switching work. That was done by the brakeman. Conductor helped, of course. We had no radios back in those days. Everything was done by hand signals. We had to be on top so we could relay signal. Half our life was spent on top of the trains. We got an engine up here, and 2.5 miles away is a caboose. In fact, we used to eat on the caboose as a crew. The conductor was a good cook. We'd pool our money, buy food. He'd have us a hot meal. I'd eat back there, and after I got through, I'd walk back over the top to the engine. That way I got out of doing the dishes. I spent a great deal of time on the head end, on the engine, because I liked it. I learned to run the locomotives, fire them. Also, we had work. When we had a train of parish, like tomatoes or anything that would take venting, this time of year was real tough. They'd come in here, they'd have to be vented. When we left Ogden, we went up 2,000 feet in 60 miles. We was going up, the temperature was going down. We'd leave here, geez, nice sunny day, you know, 60. That temperature going down all the time, so, well, at 34, those vents had to be closed. That was those brakemen and that conductor that was up on top walking along there, closing all those vents. We had several duties where we had to be on top of the car. Oh, you got used to it. I could walk along the top as easy as I could the sidewalk. Cold weather. Very, very tough on trains. Train line can freeze up. 42 years, I run away twice. Both times the air froze up. Left Evanston, 40 below zero. Tipped over the hill at Wasatch on a turbine. The engineer called me over and he says, well, he says, I've got all into her I can get into her. He says, we're going to go. He says, pick yourself a soft spot. By then, we're all doing about 40. I says, buddy, I'm staying with you. We got up to 55 miles an hour through 35 mile an hour curves, through a tunnel. We made it all right.
By 1941, an electric train was up and running around Cache Valley. It was a bit of a bumpy ride, so the people who rode it called it the Galloping Goose. Menden's Lee Larson vividly recalls the day he and his workmates set out in the railroad handcart to make routine repairs on these tracks.
So we went up to the summit and we were loading tie plates. And a train come past us while we were up there going southbound on the tracks, and we waved at them and put these tie plates loose on this flat car about 6-8 high, something like that, whatever we could stack on. And we never tied them down. We laid them so that they were pretty well loaded and we knew they would stay. And Posey called up the dispatcher to get clearance to come back to Menden. And the dispatcher said there was a train on the line. And Posey says, well, it has already passed. And that's all was said. So we took off, and it's a downhill grade all the way from the summit clear to Menden. And we got going pretty fast because we didn't have very good brakes on this little putt-putt. And we were coming down by Willie's dairy where the train made a bend when it came up from Menden, and there was a spot there that you couldn't see down the tracks. All at once, we seen the stinger, which goes from the train up to the power line on top. Well, we were in trouble, and Posey says, jump, but I had already gone, and we were going like clear up to maybe 30 miles an hour, somewhere like that. This Posey rode the putt-putt right down to the train collided with us. Well, those tie plates went like frisbees. They went everywhere you could possibly think of. Besides all the tools that were on this putt-putt, it broke all of the glass out of the front of the train. And the motorman that operated the train, he ducked under the dashboard, and the tie plates went over his head. Well, there was tie plates, it's hard to describe. Everywhere there were tie plates flying. Luckily, none of us got hit by a tie plate. And the train had a door between the compartment for the motorman to drive and the conductor that was on the back of the train. down the aisle of the passenger part, and the tie plates took the door right off, splintered it, and tie plates went clear through the train, missing everybody. I don't know where the conductor was, but he never got hit either. Okay, so the motor, our putt-putt, was like an accordion. It was so compact with being hit on both sides, front and back. And Lavelle Jones and I were on the upper side, and Posey and Don Smith were on the lower side. And we had quite a few bruises and nothing very serious at all. By that time, we were looking at the back of the train, and the thing I remember was we stood there on the track, all four of us, rubbing our scratches and bruises, and Lavelle Jones says, "Well, Posey, what are we going to do now?" And Posey says, "We are all going to get fired." And we did.
As Ogden grew into a bustling Junction City, Joe McQueen was living in a corner apartment across from the train station and playing his saxophone in local nightclubs.
Because I was playing music at night, a lot of times in the daytime, I didn't have nothing to do, and I didn't like that. So I went to work at Hill Air Force Base. And then one of the guys that was over there as a red cap was a good friend of mine, a little guy named Ed Hughes. And Ed told me, he said, "Hey, Joe, we got an opening over here for a red cap, man." He said, "Come on over here." Say, "You make about the same salary out there, but you make some good tips over here on the railroad." So I left Hill Field that day and signed up as a red cap, went to work that next night. And I worked over there all the time as a red cap. And it was all kind of people coming and going out down there. Because I used to get a lot of those movie stars on the Yellowstone Special and things like this. Boys, a lot of movie stars and things, you know. And the trains come down there jam-packed. When I first started to work over there as a red cap, they had 82 passenger trains a day coming in and out of that station. 82 passenger trains. That didn't have nothing to do with the freight trains. They were coming and going. Well, I mean, when I said day, that was day and night. Oh, they were running all night and all day. When I first started working over there, the war had been over for 5 or 6 years, but it was still a lot of soldiers and things going, you know. Like I say, that train station was jam-packed all the time. They had a barbershop in there. They had everything you wanted in that train station just about. And I'm telling you, that place used to be open 24 hours a day.
Joe McQueen continues his story, moving on to Billy Weekly opening a boarding house on 25th Street for Black Railroad porters and waiters to have a place to sleep and shower in Ogden.
Annabelle married Billy Weekly 2 years after we got here, because Billy Weekly had the Porters and Waiters Club there, and it was a place for porters and waiters when they came in town, a place for them to have a place to sleep and take showers and things like that. But when he married Annabelle, Annabelle put a restaurant in there. She asked a guy named Chambers and myself to go downstairs and get some chairs, because she had some people coming from uptown for lunch. She gave me a flashlight. She said, "I don't know what's the matter. The light's out down. It takes this flashlight, Joe, so you can see." And when I shined that flashlight and saw all that room down there and nothing being done with it and all that junk, I went back upstairs and told Annabelle. I said, "Annabelle, you got all that room. You guys ought to put a club down there." So Annabelle said, "Jojo, I'm busy. Tell Billy." So I used to drive Billy Weekly around, so I told Billy Weekly around, and he was a no-nonsense guy, and he believed in trying to make money. 3 weeks after I told him that, they cleaned that place out and started turning it into a club. Annabelle, she gave me a key. She said, "Well, you go up downstairs anytime you want to. Just let me know so I can have some food." I started one night, two, three, four, five, six, and a jam session on Sunday.
You are listening to Ride the Rails, a storytelling exploration uncovering the forgotten stories of the early railroads. Stay with us as we continue with the stories of those who lived alongside the tracks on Ride the Rails on Utah Public Radio. Ride the Rails is made possible in part by the Ogden Downtown Alliance, Ogden City, and Visit Ogden, hosting the Heritage Festival's 150th anniversary in downtown Ogden, May 9th, 10th, and 11th. Information can be found at visitogden.com. This program is also made possible with a grant from the Utah Department of Heritage and Arts and the Spike 150 Project. Information can be found at heritageandarts.utah.gov and spike150.org. Ride the Rails will be available for on-demand streaming on our website, upr.org, or on the free UPR app. You can also download the program from wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you checked out the UPR app? You can go online to your favorite app store, and with applications for Apple and Android, you can listen to UPR wherever you go, worldwide. Find us at upr.org.
Welcome back to Ride the Rails, a storytelling exploration on Utah Public Radio, uncovering the forgotten stories of the early railroads. In this segment, we'll be hearing stories from life alongside the tracks.
Throughout the train stories, we hear about the kindness of the men who worked on the trains. Most remarkable was the engine crew, who took great pains to keep a baby in a shoebox warm. Vicki Doolittle of Minden tells us the story of her mom's train journey in a shoebox.
When my mother was born, she was very premature, and they said that they could hold her in two little hands. My grandmother died when my mother was 8 weeks old, and that left my grandfather with six small children and an infant baby. So he decided it would be better for Hazel, my mother, to send her back to Minden to her grandparents, Susanna and John Ladle. So they arranged to send my mother in a little shoebox on the train. They put the baby in the engine compartment with the engineers where it was warm, with a little note that was on her from her father. "You won't have to worry about her long. She won't live very long." And so when my grandparents went to the railroad station to pick up the baby, it was very cold and wintry. They would put her in the warming oven to keep her warm, and they fed her on canned milk. And she grew to be a wonderful woman. She had a twinkle in her eye and a big smile all the time. She lived to be 79 years old. But thank heavens for the train, because I'm sure that her poor father would not have been able to get her to Minden alive by himself. So, yeah, that's my mom's story.
When the trains came to Brigham City, local farmers could ship their fruits and vegetables as far away as Butte, Montana. In the winter, duck hunters had a whole new field day. Reese Beaton talks about his grandfather, a market hunter, as he sifts through old photos and shipping receipts.
My name is Reese Beaton. I live in Brigham City. I'm 82 years young. My grandfather was Peter Knudsen of Brigham City. He was a market hunter. They hunted ducks and geese and snipes and pelicans and everything else for the meat market. And they would go out every day and shoot what they could and have them picked and prepared and put on ice and shipped to the markets. I have a picture of him in a group in print where it shows where he shot 198 ducks in 3 hours. That was October 1st. 1908. That was quite a feat even then. I have one receipt here that shows where they shipped 158 dressed teal, six mixed ducks, two mallards, one goose, two snipes, and three geese. All of that for a total of $29.61. Not a lot of money in today's market. Not only did they sell the meat, but there was a lady, Mrs. C.J. Frost from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, that sent them a letter, and she wanted to buy feathers. And they told her they'd save 200 pounds of feathers for her. She tied flies, among other things. They used the railroad to ship all summer, mainly with their fruit and produce business. And then in the winter, they would do the market hunting, and they had the connections with the railroad. They would bring them by wagon into Brigham from the duck clubs. They had pickers that took care of them and would put them on ice and ship them.
During World War I, when the Army wanted to purchase quality mules, they found the ones they were looking for in Mendon, Utah. The mules rode the train to Salt Lake City, but had to walk the last few miles up 400 South to Fort Douglas. Richard Watkins reads the story of the mules from his grandfather's memoir, A Few Experiences in Life, by Joseph Watkins.
One experience from my grandfather Watkins. He states in his written history, quote, "In 1913, Uncle Sam advertised for 7 head of mules. The specifications were very high, and the captain at Camp Douglas expected to have to inspect several owners of the mules to get the 7 head. Each mule was to be broken to hitch up and drive hitched to a wagon. We had 6 days to get them broke, as some of our mules had not been hooked up before. However, when the time was up, he accepted the 7 out of our band. One was underage, but the captain said if Uncle Sam couldn't use that one, he would keep her for himself. The mules were to be used in the war in 1914. Although animals of all kinds were cheap at that time, the government paid $200 each for the mules loaded on the car, that would be the railroad car, at Mendon, Cache County. I delivered them at Camp Douglas, leading them on horseback up 4th South Street in Salt Lake City."
High school students around Cache Valley took the train to school. This train ride often had unexpected benefits. Lee Larson and his friends were riding the train from Mendon to Hiram when they spotted a large white bird.
When we were going to school on the school train, me and my friends noticed a big white bird that was the side of the railroad track between Mendon and Wellsville in a spot. We looked at the bird for a couple of 3 days, and we had a biology class. We talked to the biology teacher, and he says, we described a bird, and he says it sounds like that was a whistling swan. They're very rare around this part of our country, and he said, I would sure like to have one, and I would mount it. Me and my friend got a gunny sack the next day, and we got them to stop the train, and we put this bird in the gunny sack. Well, by then it didn't smell very good, so we had to put it up in the baggage part in the front. We give that to the biology teacher, and he looked at it, and he says, that is a whistling swan. And it had a wingspan of about 6 feet. We assumed that it had such a long wingspan that when it landed on one of the wire that had the power in, and also another wing must have touched the ground wire and it got electrocuted. You know, I never had to worry about my grades in biology the rest of that year.
Living close to the tracks also brought its sorrows. On September 26, 1903, an 8-year-old boy, Alma Christensen, was trying to head his cow off the track when an oncoming train hit them, killing both instantly. The little boy's sister, Mabel Christensen, wrote how this tragedy was never forgotten. Mabel's niece, Lois Wilson, reads her aunt's words.
"My name is Lois Christensen Wilson. I'm 87 years old, and I live in St. George, Utah. Lars Peter Christensen, written by Mabel Christensen, daughter. My father's trunk stood in the attic of our home for years and years, and as we children were growing up, we were cautioned that we were not to open us drunk when we played in the attic on cool days. As children, we were curious as to what might be locked in that wooden box, hoping that it provided a hiding place for bags of gold or other treasure. Once I found it unlocked and took the opportunity to lift the lid, what I saw was a bundle of the clothes, torn and blood-stained, which had been worn by my 8-year-old brother, Alma, on the day, September 26, 1903, when he was struck by the engine of a train and killed as he was driving cows home from the pasture. The sight of those clothes shocked me enough so that I had no further curiosity about the trunk in the attic.
And now, not to be forgotten, thanks to all the train workers who took great care of their passengers, such as this conductor who took a frightened 6-year-old carefully under his wing.
I was probably only 6 years old. My mother used to take me down to the railroad station on 5th West and Forest Street in Brigham. She'd put me on the train and tell the conductor to put me off at Beaton, which was a stop halfway between Deweyville and Collingston. So I'd get on the train scared to death that I may never see anybody again and be lost forever. And I'd ride the train, and when we got up to Beaton, the conductor would come and get me and put me off. My aunt would be there to pick me up, and this would generally be on a Friday or Saturday. Mother would always tell the conductor, now stop Sunday on the afternoon train and pick him up. And so we'd be up there when the afternoon train come, and train had come, and sure enough, it would slow down and stop, and the conductor would step out and take my hand. I'd get on the train, and he'd make sure I got off in Brigham. They took really good care of you then.
Living alongside the tracks inevitably brought tramps riding the rails adrift and hungry to your back gate. Mothers and wives often found the tramps at their back door, but you can imagine the surprise of Richard Watkins' grandmother, who returned home one day to find 3 tramps seated at her kitchen table.
My Watkins grandparents lived close to the railroad tracks in Brigham City, and my grandmother Watkins was very generous in sharing what she had with so-called tramps, and there were many of them. They would come to the Watkins home hoping to get a little something to eat. Well, on one occasion, Grandma came into the kitchen, and there were 2 or 3 of these tramps seated at her table, and she was quite surprised and said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And one of them said, "Well, we became aware of a message that we could go to your place for a good meal." That was the word that apparently was spread around there amongst the tramps at the railroad. And, she fed them.
Hazel Jones shared a story at the Ogden Library. Her husband, a railroad cook for 39 years, treated his young daughter to a meal fit for a princess after hours in the dining car, including the fine china, the best silver, and especially the finger bowl.
We wouldn't go in the dining room when they were feeding. We'd go in later, and the guys would treat us just like they would everybody else, you know. It was so funny, my baby girl. They sent the little bowl, the finger bowl, and they had some of the best silver in the world on the chain. It was just so elegant at that time. And she thought it was a cup that you put drink out of.
Yeah.
And so my husband told her, "No, honey, you have to clean your fingers with that." And so she said, "Well, why?" She was only about 2 years old.
You are listening to Ride the Rails, a storytelling exploration uncovering the forgotten stories of the early railroads. We invite you to stay with us for the last third with more railroad worker stories on Ride the Rails on Utah Public Radio. Ride the Rails is made possible in part by the Ogden Downtown Alliance, Ogden City, and Visit Ogden, hosting the Heritage Festival's 150th anniversary in downtown Ogden, May 9th, 10th, and 11th. Information can be found at visitogden.com. This program is also made possible with a grant from the Utah Department of Heritage and Arts and the Spike 150 Project. Information can be found at heritageandarts.utah.gov and spike150.org. Ride the Rails will be available for on-demand streaming on our website, upr.org, or on the free UPR app. You can also download the program from wherever you get your podcasts.
UPR is everywhere you are. With classical music programming, news and information statewide through 36 signals, worldwide on the web at upr.org and through the online app. UPR is only a push of the button away.
Welcome back for the conclusion of Utah Public Radio's Ride the Rails, a storytelling exploration uncovering the forgotten stories of Utah's early railroads. In this conclusion, we hear from railroad workers C.D. Davis, Norm Frost, and Gene Knopper.
Though he swore he'd never work on the railroad, C.D. Davis got talked into signing up for the extra board and found himself assigned to a 30-day stint on the Sugar Beet Dump in Cache Junction.
My father worked for the railroad, and I swore up and down I would never work for a railroad because I never saw him. He was always gone somewhere on a train. I'm working in a bowl now, and yardmaster, I didn't know who he was at the time. He came in and was watching me bowl. We got to talking, and I found out he was a yardmaster for the Union Pacific down here in the East Yard in Salt Lake City. And he says, would you be interested in working for the railroad? I says, oh, no. And he said, well, just for the summer, we're short of men. And I was looking for a construction job to open up anyway. So I says, yeah, what the heck, I'll go ahead and go. Well, I got down there, and I liked it. Cache Junction, I worked out there on the beat jobs and all that stuff. There was two jobs, one day and one night. I always got the night job. You're on the extra board, and when the job comes open, you go to that job. Most of the time, it was the old heads had the day jobs because nobody wanted to work all night in the wintertime on a beat job, freezing, and snow up to your hips. There was facilities to house 10 men, five shacks, man on each end, shared the same bathroom. Oh, that was, we ate at the Beanery, and it was open 24 hours a day. It was a regular restaurant. The counter held about eight, and there was probably four or five booths. A lot of people used to come over there just to eat. In 1968, when I hired out, they could work you 16 hours a day. You know, you work 16 hours. You get off work, you got to go in and tie up. And then you go to your room and take a shower. And then you got to go eat, and that's an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then the railroad always gave you an hour and a half call before you were on duty so you could get up, shower, and go eat and be ready to go to work. So now you got 3 hours out of your 8 hours rest gone. So you'll sleep for 5 hours, maybe. And that's what we did. That's how we lived, 30 days. I still, to this day, don't sleep over 5 hours.
C.D. continues with two stories of dark territories in Utah, where trains still follow the old ways of doing things.
And then you have what they call dark territory, where there's no train orders. You have a little box with a stick in it. You open that little box. If the stick's there, you can go. If it ain't there, you stay there until somebody brings the stick. That means there's a train already out there doing work. Little Mountain Branch was that way. Out of Ogden, go out to the salt mill out there. You have to have that staff before you can go. That keeps you from having Casey Joneses. And there has been times when they forgot to put it back in there. They have to call the guy up and get him out of bed and have him bring the staff back. Of course, he got highly reprimanded for that. We was on a stack train. They applied the brakes and they wouldn't release because it froze. Because it was, what, 20 below or something there at Farmington. See, anytime you're messing with air, it's got moisture in it. And that's what freezes, is the moisture. You get so much, you're pumping the air through that train all the time, you're pumping a lot of moisture in there. And it gets in those cylinders, and when you apply the brakes, it'll go in there and freeze. Okay, now they're applied and froze. they will not release. If we was in dark territory, the rear brakeman has to go back a mile and a half behind that train and protect it. And the head man has to go a mile and a half ahead of it and protect it. You have what you call torpedoes. They're little square things of sulfur that you put on the track. And when the train runs over, it makes a big explosion. It goes boom. And you put them 25 feet apart or so. So you go boom, boom. That tells that engineer he's being flagged. Be prepared to stop it within a mile. If there's a flagman there, he has to stop. And the flagman has to be a half a mile behind the train. And he cannot move until he's recalled by the train that it stopped. But it's a mile and a half protection. A 5,000-ton train doing 50 miles an hour takes a mile and a quarter to come to a complete stop in emergency. That's if all the brakes are in good working order.
Finally, CD tells us about dog trains, how they would die, and how a dog catcher would sometimes have to go out and catch them.
We have what's called dog trains, which are drags. You do everything there is to do from point A to point B, and you have a lot of time to work. And you may make it, and you may not. I would get to what they call the 279, with Salt Lake to Pocatello. There's all these industries along the way. They all had little set-out tracks for furniture stores and things like that. Logan, you set out a Cass Junction for all the Oakland Preston business, and you go up to Swan Lake and Downey, they had stuff, and Aramo had the propane outfit there, and you get into McCammon and get down the hill into Pocatello. When you run out of time, the train stops. Federal law. You cannot work past your hours of service. The train stops, and they have what they call deadhead crew to come out and get you. Dog catching, they call it. Some dog train died, so they got to go out and catch it.
Keeping time accurately was so important on the railway that a worker could be fired if his watch was 15 seconds off. Norm Frost fills us in on this part of the train story.
We used to have a standard clock. Each member of the crew would go compare time with this standard clock before you went to work. Then, as you went to work, the brakeman would compare time with the conductor. Then the conductor would compare time with the engineer and the fireman. Then as the head brakeman went to work, he'd compare time with the engineer. Now, time was very, very essential. You had to be right within seconds all the time with your watch. Now, most of our track was double track, and it really wasn't as serious as on single track. On single track, why, you get a watch 2 or 3 minutes off and have someone pull out 3 minutes ahead of time, you might head right into someone. That's why our watches have to be so accurate and within so many seconds on these railroads. A lot of people wondered why you had to be and why they were so strict. They had one instance east of Green River, Wyoming, during a spell when they had one rail tied up. They had a stretch of single track several miles long. This engineer had his orders to go at such and such a time. The timer came and he took off. Well, his clock was 4 minutes fast. He took right off. He just got the train onto the main line before the conductor could take action. Here come the train around the curve and him killed, I think, six of them. That was in all late 40s. Our watch was inspected every 6 weeks in Ogden. We went to a professional timekeeper that would inspect it. And we had timekeepers on the road that would check us. Your watch had to be within 15 seconds. If they caught you over 15 seconds off with your watch, they could actually fire you. I got a Hamilton 21 Jewel. I carried it for 42 years. I think it was $90. That was about what a house cost, you know. Boy, it took a long time to pay for that watch. But that was essential. You had to have that before you could go to work.
Meanwhile, back in Ogden, Gene Knopper worked his way through school with summer jobs at the Ogden station.
Cyril Eugene Knopper. I worked in mainly the laundry. I also worked in the commissary, and I also worked in the baggage room at the Union Station. And summer jobs paid my way through college. Trains coming into Ogden would telegraph an order for supplies. So we would get telegrams from the train crews, and we would take that telegram into the laundry or to the commissary, and we'd fill out order for what they needed to finish the end of their trip. A normal trip from the city of Los Angeles was from Los Angeles to Chicago, and so they would start out of Los Angeles fully stocked. And after the dinner meal, the chef would wire ahead to us for what they needed for the breakfast the next morning, lunch, and the dinner meal. And then when they got to Omaha, they would wire ahead to Omaha, and they would get the food stuff that they needed to get them into Chicago. That order from Reno would usually be at about midnight. And so I had till about 9 o'clock in the morning to get that ready for that train, because that's what it would pull in. The chef would say, here's what I need. And he might say, I need 4 steaks. And sometimes I'd get an order for a halibut. There was always bread they needed and rolls. And, of course, there's always the coffee you needed. And they cooked with Presto logs and charcoal briquettes. That was the source of heat for the ovens and the range. Every time I went to took an order for a dining car, I always took Presto logs.
The mail trains pulled into Ogden in the dead of night, and Gene and his workmates were there to unload them.
I worked the night shift, and that job was primarily to unload the mail trains. We had baggage wagons lined up. They would throw us mail bags out of the mail car, and we would stack them on baggage wagons, stacked high with sacks of mail. It was cold work, it was hard work, and it was dark work. That was a hard job out there.
The Union Pacific sent all its laundry to Ogden, a huge operation. Gene takes us inside to see how this facility churned out crisp and clean sheets, tablecloths, waiters' jackets, and more.
A train would come in, and the dining car would throw out bags of used laundry. They throw it out on the platform. They pull a linen hamper out and put it on a baggage cart. And then those carts would be dragged over to the south end of the laundry. Okay, let me go from there to the washroom, where there are 10 washing machines. The washers did not spin, just rotated. And the extractor, we had an overhead crane, and the round tub would be dropped into the extractor, and the extractor would spin all the water out of them. I was thinking, boy, they would really spin. The flat stuff, like the tablecloths and the napkins, went to 4 what we call mangles, which were presses. That was the girls' job now, was to shake out the sheets and the tablecloths and the napkins and place them on the conveyor belt into the pressers. They would come out on the other end dry, and they would drop into a folder, and the machine would fold them. They were folded nice. They were folded, I guess, you know, in half and then half again. And they would stack as they came off out of the press. And the girls that were working on that end put them on a conveyor belt. And the conveyor belt would run them down to the west end of the laundry, where a young lady would take them off the conveyor belt, and she'd put them on a tying machine, and she'd push a button and it'd tie the napkins into bundles. There was also a sewing room in there. When the press girl saw that there was something wrong with the coat, she'd send it over to the sewing room, and the girls would repair the tear or fix the collar or put a button back on it. There was quite a bit of work for those ladies.
Gene's last journey takes us into the dining car, where he worked as a steward.
My last job for the Union Pacific Railroad was a steward on the dining cars, and the steward would price out your meal, and then the waiter would bring you your meal, and then when the meal was over with, we'd give you the amount of money that you owed. And there was strictly cash. There was a cash drawer in there. We didn't have any checks. We didn't have any credit cards. The railroad used 3 things on a dining car table. They had a pad that went on for the table first. Then the next thing was a table cloth. Lastly was a table top. Now, the table top was changed after every serving at the table. The table cloth was changed between meals. When you sat down in the dining car, you had a clean tablecloth, tabletop, and you had a clean napkin in front of you. They washed all the dishes on the train. It was all hand washed. There were no dishwashers. The waiters washed their own dishes, and the cooks washed the pots and pans. On one of those trips coming back, there was a derailment ahead of us. So the train got stopped, and we weren't going to go anywhere. This was summertime, and we were there for about noon, and that car got hot. We did not have refrigeration cooling in the dining cars. We had blocks of dry ice, and the batteries went dead on the dining car, so we lost all the fans and everything. So all the food started to spoil, so we fed everybody we could, all the food we could, and then all the ice cream was melting. We just pulled it out, and anybody came in, we gave them a dish. And our crews couldn't do anything. All we could do was just sit there. They were building a bypass, which was called a shoe fly. In other words, they built a spur track from the last good point on the rail through the wreck back up to the next good point on the rail. And they would run us down through the shoe fly, then back up on the main line. They finally got us rolling. We were close to 8 hours late getting into Denver. The ride down through the Columbia River Gorge was a beautiful ride on the train, and it was hard to concentrate on the dining car. So much beautiful scenery going by on the Columbia River and the gorge up there, that was really beautiful. I enjoyed working on the railroad. I felt that was a job that you were contributing something, you know, and you could see the results of your work.
For the last 2 months, we've been packaging small railroad stories and putting them on the air. Thanks to all who contributed. And now, we'd like to run the whole story train right past you into the final station.
There was a time when, in Franklin, if you stood beside the tracks with a letter held up high on a stick, the passing train would slow down, collect it, and send it on its way.
When the Ringling Brothers Circus train pulled into Merkur, Utah, a mining town in the Ochre Mountains, the townspeople were disappointed to see that no elephants got off the train. Where were the elephants? They had been put off the train miles back. The train couldn't pull them up the steep grade.
The Train by Catherine Skelton. One afternoon, my cousin and I were walking along the tracks with Graham when she slipped and hurt her ankle. She couldn't walk, and we couldn't seem to help her much. Oh dear, what to do? Then we heard the train whistle in the distance. Hooray, help at last! The big question was, could we get it to stop for two young girls? We waved, yelled help, and somehow it worked. We were grateful that the train would stop for us. The men on the train got our grandmother onto it for the couple of miles into town. Fortunately, the tracks went right by the hospital and all ended well.
Strange, thought the Ogden station master, as he agreed to escort a passenger from the train on a stroll up 25th Street. Two men in blue suits followed them every step of the way. After the woman thanked him and reboarded the train, the word got around. That was Eleanor Roosevelt. Grace Warner stood in her regular place by the side of the railroad tracks in Weber Canyon. As the train chugged by, Grace threw her sack towards the train. Her husband, Homer, who worked on the train, leaned out and deftly snagged it. Grace and Homer were good at this sack toss. It was his lunch.
In the 1940s, printing pictures in the Millard County Chronicle required the photos to take a quick trip on a speeding train from Delta to Salt Lake City. The photos, placed in a satchel, were snagged by a hook as the train flew by. Once in Salt Lake City, a photo lab transformed them into halftone dots that duplicated the images. By morning, the metal plates glued to blocks of wood measuring exactly the same height as the slugs of the newspaper type were back on the return trip in their satchel, ready to be inserted into the front page of the town's weekly paper.
During the war years, when the troop train stopped in the Ogden station, the soldiers would run upstairs to the Red Cross canteen for coffee and cookies. Lucky the day when a soldier son of a volunteer had a birthday. She made a cake.
When the roads between Black Rock and Milford got too muddy to drive, that didn't slow Georgia Thompson's dad down. He hitched a ride on a freight train to Black Rock to see his sweetheart for the evening and caught another train home to Milford when the date was over. And that sweetheart was Georgia's mother. In the 1880s, the new railroad needed ties, and woodcutters cut and stacked them along the Provo River. In the spring, they threw the ties into the rising water to float down to the rail line. When the ties jammed up, men jumped on top with spiked poles to dislodge the jams. Sometimes a man could walk on top of those jammed ties as much as a mile down the river.
The Ogden station manager was holding the train. He called the girls in the pep club at Ogden High School, and they came running. Graciously, one passenger stepped onto the platform, mingled with the girls for a few minutes, and signed autographs. Elvis Presley was just passing through. When the men went off to the Second World War, women took over the hard and often dangerous job of wiping the greasy sludge off the engines. These women wrapped their heads in red bandanas, put on red lipstick, and went to work. They call the bright red lipstick Victory Red. At a railroad crossing outside Preston, a car tried to beat an oncoming train across the tracks. The train nicked the car and threw it onto a ditch. The railroad man found a woman sitting in the back seat of the crumpled car. "Where's the driver? Where's the driver?" he shouted. The woman said, "I am the driver." During World War II, the troop trains would stop at the coal mining town of Wellington. The town kids would run down to talk to the soldiers. They would mail letters for them. And this was the best part of all. The train brought them heroes.
In the little mining town of Kenilworth, Utah, Ronald Jukes' mother was struck by a train on the railroad tracks that came past the company store. The only thing that saved her was a heavy fur coat she was wearing. This heavy coat caught on the cowcatcher. She rolled into a ball and was rolled down the tracks. Virginia Gordon writes, "A large trestle built across the canyon to reach the sweet mine near the city of Consumers, Utah, became a daring and dangerous playground for many younger children. It was always a challenge to get across the trestle without getting caught between the ties and by the train. If we were trapped by the train for a while, we'd hike up the mountain to pick wildflowers to take home to our mothers."
In Stockton, Utah, mothers still tell their daughters to be home before the midnight train goes by, or Charlie Ping won't get them. Who is Charlie Ping? Years ago, Charlie fell in front of a train and got his head cut off. They say Charlie is still out there looking for his head, and if he finds you, he'll take yours. When he was 15, Judge Raymond Uno got a summer job hammering spikes for the railroad. He was half the age and half the size of his co-workers. 8 hours in the hot sun, always the same. Tap the spike into place, swing the spike maul. 1, 2, 3. Pick up the next spike. When Cache Valley's sugar beets were loaded into train cars, they took quite a pounding. The farmers ran their wagons up a ramp and then tipped the beets down a steep slope of wooden slats. Dirt flew everywhere as the beets bounced down the ramp into the train car waiting below. The farmers were paid by the pound, and the sugar beet factories didn't want to pay for the dirt.
A teacher passed through a major earthquake completely unaware while riding the train and only heard about it from her colleagues after she got off Cache Valley's affectionately named Galloping Goose. But she wasn't surprised. Said Renee Karen, riding in that thing was an earthquake all by itself. Additional thanks for these stories goes to Jeannie Campbell, Barbara Bergman, Jane Beckwith, Lyndia Carter, Jackie Thane, Utah State University Special Collections, local chapters of Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, and Lori Brassaw of the USU Eastern Library and Learning Commons. This is Kirsten Swanson.
And this is Mary Hears.
For Utah Public Radio. Ride the Rails is made possible in part by the Ogden Downtown Alliance, Ogden City, and Visit Ogden, hosting the Heritage Festival's 150th anniversary in downtown Ogden, May 9th, 10th, and 11th. Information can be found at visitogden.com. This program is also made possible with a grant from the Utah Department of Heritage and Arts and the Spike 150 Project. Information can be found at heritageandarts.utah.gov and spike150.org. Ride the Rails will be available for on-demand streaming on our website, upr.org, or on the free UPR app. You can also download the program from wherever you get your podcasts. Ride the Rails is an original production by Utah Public Radio, with Program Director Mary Hears, Lead Producer Kirsten Swanson, Research Assistant Rachel Ross, and Project Manager Danny Hayes. Special thanks to Karen Krieger, USU Special Collections, Rick Hughes, and Ogden Union Station. The music is "I've Been Working on the Railroad" by the Tremaine Orchestra.